Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, a roundtable on design in unexpected places. What does it mean to bring the principles and art of great design to an economically and racially segregated city? How do you get rocket scientists at NASA interested in design? Where does it fit into our daily lives, our daily world? Three guests have brought their experience and ideals on design to the studio today. Majora Carter is CEO of Majora Carter Group. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Antoinette Carroll is a social impact design activist and the founder of Creative Reaction Lab, and the organization was formed after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thank you for having me here.
Jesse Kawada is a visual strategist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Welcome. Good
Thank
to have you,
you
here.
Thank you.
Majora, I think when we bring up design, many of us who maybe don't live in the kind of space that you guys live in all the time think design, bricks and mortar, solid, you know, things I can see and touch. But I know that you think about different dimensions of design. So what would you say about that?
Well, it is bricks and mortar. A great community really is based on how well or how not well it's designed. But the design actually speaks to the needs of how people see themselves living in the community. Does it meet all of their creature comforts? Does it meet their spiritual needs? Does it meet their need for community with other people? Like, does it meet their needs, you know, for decent jobs and great places to hang out in and shop? And those kind of things are absolutely part of design when you think about how you can develop a community as well.
Yeah, see, that's the thing is, I guess I think when I see a beautifully designed space or building, it occupies that kind of idea. But day to day, as I'm going through my life, I am hardly ever thinking about how I can be in the world and thanks to where design fits into that. Jesse, Antoinette?
You know, for me, design is truly that invisible innovation.
Okay.
When we take into consideration of design, everything around us has been designed. The clothes you're wearing, that mug you're holding right now in your hand.
Right.
You know, so you have those physical products, those artifacts. But then, you know, design is also a process in the way that you approach problem solving.
Tell me about that.
Well, when you think about government officials, and, you know, when they are developing policies, they're thinking about a specific problem and they're designing a solution to it. Mm-hmm. Whenever we're in a brainstorming meeting about where our business should go next, that is a design problem, and you're using creative problem solving to come up with that solution. So you have that physical kind of image of design, which is what most people typically think of.
Right.
But design in itself is actually how we approach the problems, and, you know, overall, whether it's systemic problems, social good, or it's just problems in our daily lives of how am I walking down the street? Is it easy for me to walk down the steps? You know, is this accessible to people that use wheelchairs? Those are all problems that design methodology easily comes into.
See, I don't think of like a brainstorming meeting as an exercise in design, but it is. Mm-hmm. Jesse, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's really all about brainstorming and process to me. Design thinking is a way to expand ideas, to open up your willingness to just, you know, say bad ideas. Like, bad ideas are okay. And I think that idea generation process is really important. Because creative ideas for artists and designers come from anywhere. They come, you know, you could be walking, you could be taking a shower, you could be driving a car. And a bad idea can become a good idea at the end of the day. So the brainstorming is really just a way to get people together and collaborate and work with other designers or creative people and outside of the creative industry to kind of collaborate and bring all those ideas together. Really.
But if you three were going to say you can bring the principles of design to an everyday problem-solving kind of conversation, how would that be different than if you were not bringing the principles of design into that? That's what I want to understand. What makes the difference?
Well, for me, and that's a very tricky question because it depends on the designer that you talk to. Because, you know, there's some designers that really believe, and I'm one of those, that you have the technically trained designers that went to school and they're the ones that really can develop solutions around these ambiguous problems, right? And it's the complexity of our society. But then you have everyday designers or common people that literally just approach problems in a kind of more creative mindset, which many times we lose in kindergarten. And, you know, we have those round circles with colorful mats. And then by the time we get to high school, we're in what I call the prison rows of chairs and desks because, you know, we're told, okay, it should only be about analytics versus, you know, how the emotion and how we feel. And with design and design thinking is truly a combination of both. And, you know, I also look at design as a representation of our history and, you know, our transition through time as human beings. When we were thinking about, you know, how to drive a car, it didn't start with the car. It started with a rock and someone carving it and making a wheel. And then how do I get from point A to point B? And, you know, from the car, it went to the train and it went to airplanes. And, you know, and literally that's design. It's literally the representation of how we are evolving as human beings. Everything that has been man-made has been designed.
Right. And I think to add to that, one of the interesting, because look, I'm not a designer by training. You know, I was actually a cinema studies major in college and fine arts after that. And but I know enough about design to be really dangerous.
I mean, design informs everything
exactly.
that you were doing.
And what I think what's interesting about, you know, looking at design is I do believe everybody's a designer. Most people just don't feel confident feeling as mm-hmm. though like what that their approach to looking and viewing the world, you know, actually is valid compared to someone who actually has training. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the problem, you know, because I think people who live in communities that are challenged in one way, shape, or another, they can tell you really quickly what is wrong and what needs to change. Now, do they feel confident to be able to say that? That's the problem that I think we need to address and why the idea of design thinking is something that we need to demystify so that folks can actually take advantage of what goes on up in their heads and actually bring those good ideas out to bear into the world so that we can actually do something with it and not being afraid of failure because we when we get to failure fast, if like those brainstorming mm-hmm. things, which we were talking about before, like having the ability to like throw everything out on the table and then see what's really great and not be afraid to put a bad idea out there because who knows what it's going to turn into. And that sense of confidence is something I think we have to try to instill in more people than we do.
You know, Jesse, when Antoinette was talking about the idea of the emotionality mm-hmm. versus the analysis, I mean, you work with rocket scientists. Mm-hmm. I don't think these are, whether it's true or not, these are men and women who think of themselves as emotional first and analytic mm-hmm. second, right? Is mm-hmm. is that a culture you had to address to bring design into a place like the JPL?
Yeah. Well, working there, you talk to people and they always make a joke. They're Jesse's putting emotion back into science, right? They're making us more emotional. And I'm like, well, I guess I am to an extent. I've heard that scientists are academically trained not to put emotion into their science, but when you connect and you apply it to something, when you need to show the public what you're doing, you have to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. You have to show the public that there's a reason why we're doing this, and this has to do with them.
Right.
This has to do, you know, sometimes it's not just about the science or space or the science of space. It's really just about how humans connect with who they are.
Jesse, some of the most creative, imaginative people I know are scientists. I don't get this thing about you have to take the imagination and the emotionalism out of science. Mm-hmm. I think that's a bad rap.
It's a bad rap, you know, but I think it's important to know that the value of two ways of approaching or two ways of thinking, mm-hmm. you know, if they can focus on the science of it, and then they bring you bring in creative folk, you bring in storytellers to collaborate with the scientists, you know, you approach a problem in two different directions. But then it becomes one direction. And I think I consider myself as a storyteller working with a scientist, they sort of adapt and adopt these sort of ways of storytelling. And then I sort of start to understand their science.
Okay, so, give me an example of this, because this sounds really interesting. How does it work? And a hard example of how this happened.
You know, I've been reading lots of science papers recently mm-hmm. About, you know, climate change and about Earth. And You know, if we wanted to do a mission, these science stories, they're really just about looking at the micro, looking at, you know, we need to study these molecules in a storm or water vapor in the atmosphere. But I try to take them back a little bit, looking at the bigger picture. Why are you doing this? Really, who are you doing it for? You know, we really, it's the why, the what, the who, the where, and then just taking them back and asking simple questions, you know, like, why would people care about this? Mm-hmm. And that helps them to formulate their story, because really it's a pitch in anything. And it, even if, you know, it's a proposal or if it's a review or if it's a science paper or a presentation, it's a pitch no matter what, you know, even if it's not a product or it's, you know, there's no market to it. So in that case, you need to sell something, sell an idea, and storytelling is a way to do it, I think.
How does storytelling fit into both of what you two do, Majora and Antoinette?
It's difficult for me to explain it because it's all integrated into all of the work that I do. For me, when I approach design, I look at it at the people level. Many times we have lost that human element. Especially when we look at social issues, we say, oh, we have the issue of cancer. We're not saying we're looking at the issue through the lens of people that have been affected by cancer. But no, we just have this big grandiose breast cancer. Let's raise research for, you know, money for research around these issues. Or when we look at racism, racism is the word, you know, and it's so systemic. It's so hard to approach. And too many times we focus on that macro versus getting back to that micro.
Right.
And for me, storytelling is a role within that, because when you get back to the micro and the people level, no one can tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, only you can explain what you go through. And so when I approach design problems, right now it's this really big emergence of human-centered design. And to me, human-centered design isn't enough because it still has this top-down approach. I want you to come in, give me insight. I'm going to attempt to walk in your shoes, and then I'm going to come up with the solutions that I think should work for you based on my analysis of what you've told me, and then I'll bring you back, give me some feedback, and we have this back and forth, versus having people actually at the table with equal decision making and, you know, acknowledging that the people that are affected by many of these issues, whether it is something that's socially relevant or whether it's just a business idea, their ideas are just as valid as the person that's been trained. Harvard Business Review is like, when the Harvard Business Review writes, dedicates a magazine to you, you've made it, right?
But and they've got a design review issue.
Okay. There you go. But what's now happening is that people are so focused on the term design thinking that they're taking designers out of the process. Mm-hmm. And for designers, they do have this innate ability to problem solve in these very complex
narratives.
What do
you mean they're taking them out of the process?
So many times, and I can just speak from personal experience, where I've gone to fellowship programs and I've worked with people that are within the social space with United Nations or Ashoka, and they will go through a 45-minute design thinking training and say, I got it. And then they essentially take it back to their office and said, I'm going to train you to be a design thinker, even though I, you know, apparently only received my, you know, credibility in 45 minutes. And so you have these people that, yes, I'm happy that you're bringing design thinking to the table, but you're excluding the designers that actually, they innately do this every single day. You know, it's like taking the scientists out of NASA and saying, you know, I study scientific methodology for 45 minutes. So I'm going to take you out and now I'm going to build the rocket ship. You know, it's like, no, we need you to appreciate it. We need you to still be creative. Everyone can be creative. That's free. But, you know, some things does merit still having designers at the table, which unfortunately has led to a lot of exclusion.
Because I'm just curious about this because I really don't know. In my work, there definitely is, you know, partnership. Again, I'm not a designer by training and never, but I am a designer, you know, I have to be, and that's what we do. You know, if you're talking about the business of actually helping to create real urban revitalization strategies and community, you better be good at design and understanding history and like what trajectory actually can be. I always found that it was really important to actually have folks that could actually help you put meat on the bones of like the ideas that one has, which isn't necessarily taking them out, but it also does mean you're honoring, you know, the input of folks that actually will be living with this stuff before and after you leave.
Yeah, and that is so important. And that's why I say, you know, human-centered design is not, because right now we, as designers, we are kind of going into this I mean, like, going to get, like, kicked out of AIGA from this. But going into this, like, flawed mindset where, you know, we are, you know, we do have this us versus them mentality, just to be completely honest. Mm-hmm. And when we approach problems through Creative Reaction Lab, and these are not small issues we're looking at. We're looking at gun violence. We're looking at school-to-prison pipeline. For us, you need to have four stakeholders always at the table with equal decision-making process, and that's the business sector because they are experts on scale. Mm-hmm. And then you need to have the social and civic representation because they are the experts on the theory of the problem, as well as, you know, how it's actually playing a role in our economy and within, you know, larger populations. Then you have designers because they're experts on problem solving and really developing solutions around, you know, ambiguous situations. And then you have the living experts, which are the community members and people that are affected by the problem itself. And when you have all four of them at the table, not one, not three, not two, that's when you develop the most effective solution.
Right.
So, you know, for me, I feel that many times we have taken the designers out of the equation, or we've taken the community members out of the equation and said, I know how to develop the solution based on my perspective coming into it, where we need all four of these to truly be representative and be able to impact as many people as possible.
I've noticed that a lot of people outside just the industry think that design comes at the end. And it's just a way to really communicate an idea. You know, it's because we're good
fluffy.
At it. It's I mean, it is. I mean,
it's like it's an add-on thing as opposed to like what it's not a function. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I think what everybody's sort of saying right now is that design should exist in the beginning and exist during the planning stages, during the strategic stages, during the business planning stages. And, you know, then the design and the storytelling and the communication will be great at the end, will be even more compelling and better when you really integrate all of these roles together in the beginning. And I don't think people are used to that. I don't think the world is really used to integrating design in the beginning, creative thinking. But I feel like I've heard more about those instances recently. And I have hope that, you know, in the future, more designers will be involved.
Do you think, this is going back to something you said, Antoinette, that the business community thinks that they should be factoring this in and understanding where design fits, but that they're still pretty inherently suspicious of what designers are going to bring to it in the end? And maybe that's, again, why it's left to the end and why there's a 45-minute training. And now I know what I'm talking about, and I'm going back to train everybody else at the company.
I don't know if it's because we think differently. I mean, I'm going to be honest. We're weird people because we're amazing at the same time. But, you know, designers, you know, I look at design and design thinking as a social science, which we don't really refer to it as such. And it's interesting you mentioned, like, I wasn't trained in design. I was trained in design, but I also was trained in communications, which is a social science. And, you know, compared to, you know, biology or chemistry, it's like, oh, well, you're about emotions. You're about the touchy-feely. But, you know, it is really about bringing that emotion back to the table. And with the business sector, they're bringing it back a lot more. I will say they're saying we need design at the table because they're actually seeing the return on investment. You know, it had to show that hard evidence of what the impact of design can make opposed to just branding. But it took many, many decades for it to happen. You had Coca-Cola, you have IBM, you have these big corporations where design is at the forefront. And then now with technology being so prevalent in our society, you see a lot of successful organization being started and led by designers, which is adding value to our work. But yet, when you think about business, it still is very much a more hierarchical type of setup, and it's hard to create change. And designers still in a nonprofit sector, whether it's business, is being pushed to the other side and saying, I still don't truly understand what you do, because as even designers, we have difficulty sometimes explaining this is the value that I bring to the table, because some of it is very anecdotal. It is very like at the base emotional level, opposed to hard sciences of saying I can raise the impact of your work by 75% because I designed XYZ or I helped you bring creativity into the work. Creativity is hard to really measure.
Right.
And because of that, you know, design is still hard for many of these organizations and these entities to say, I see the value of design to bring it at the beginning. But thankfully, we have some organizations that are leading the forefront, but it requires kind of evolution of thinking on both sides of the table.
It's interesting because I think if you say Apple and Steve Jobs to people and that's the way you're going to describe what design is, I think people kind of get that. Like he elevated the idea of design and utility and beauty. But I know there's so many other different, just from listening to this conversation so far, there's so many other different dimensions of that. And maybe that's what we don't understand. You were going to say.
But, you know, with Steve Jobs, like, what do we hear? Apple and Steve Jobs. We don't hear Apple and John Ivey, the designer behind the work.
Right.
You know, we hear about the person that was at the forefront, that he was a design thinker, be honest. But you don't hear about the technically trained designer in the back. You know, you hear about the person in front of the room. And so, yes, it's a great example of innovation, but it still in itself it's still pushing design to the back burner. Many people, when they think about, actually they don't think about design. When you're wearing the clothes, no one is saying, you know, so-and-so designed this. You know, when you talk to youth and you say, do you actually think Michael Jordan designed those shoes? They say yes.
But part of this, Antoinette, I think is, when you said this about the clothes, it reminded me that I also think there's a probably wrong perception of a kind of elitism around design. There's a certain class in our community that has access to that kind of design, and the everyday world that we live in, we don't experience that. That's I think that's working against you.
Well, and then I'm trying
I'm
to take over the conversation.
No, but go ahead.
Just because when I hear it, to me, it takes it back to, you know, if we're talking about specific types of design, because majority of society, as far as I know, wear clothes every day.
You're exactly right. But I'm saying, I think this is the misperception around,
I don't know. What's your thoughts? What has value? I mean, it's not as if the, Nike or whoever makes Jordans. I'm sorry, I have no idea. That's really embarrassing. but the point is, like, they know that people are attracted to brands, so that's why it's like, that's why. So for those kids, that is exactly what that company wants them to believe. That Michael Jordan personally said, "This is I'm sticking my name on that." That's exactly. So they're brilliant in that regard, and I think that. But it's that inherent value that we, you know, take in when we see things that mean something to us. And so I think to the point about, you know, be who's at the table as we start to plan and design and strategize about the future. And even in that regard, who has value? Okay. And so you're right. I think the private sector, you know, it's the business interests that are looking at this like, oh, absolutely. Like, you know, because we know best because we're the job creators and da-da-da, which is awesome. I mean, I'm all for creating jobs. And then there's also, you know, the, like, I guess the cities or whoever, I mean, like the government, you know, entities associated
and nonprofits.
With them. Yeah. And who are just sort of like, okay, we know best because we've done these studies and we know da-da-da-da. And then you've got, you know, the designers who actually do put the meat on the bones of, like, what's going on. And then there's also the community folks who actually know, like, literally what's needed. And especially, I think, in terms of trying to understand, like, how do we build communities, especially low status communities in this country that have been just, I think, at the best, you know, neglected and at worst, absolutely abused in terms of how design has been actively used against us. I don't care if it's a Native American reservation or an inner city ghetto, you know, or a former Rust Belt town, you know, that's just been left withered to its own devices. And how are we going to use design thinking and bring everybody on so that people, every one of those four that you mentioned, everyone is considered valuable. And as someone, like, I don't even call myself an activist anymore. Like,
you don't? Actually,
no, absolutely
why?
Not.
Why? You kind of recoiled.
Because I did. I'm sorry if the viewing public. And it's not that I don't think it's important, but I recognize, you know, after watching, you know, just the way that I was treated as someone who started doing urban revitalization work, you know, in an inner city ghetto, and how folks would, like, look at activists as kind of like, oh, you know, that's a good thing you're doing, but ultimately you don't really have value. When it comes right down to it. And I would see it just in terms of, like, you should be able to put your information down. You should be able to give input. But, you know, it's not so, and you know, it's not of value because no one really wanted to actually pay them for the work that they brought.
Well, I mean, I want to pursue that for a second. So you believe that the perception of activism is something for one thing, you're doing out of
the kindness of your heart.
Exactly. That, and, that shouldn't be compensated for. And isn't it kind of quaint that she's all in on it?
Yeah, it's adorable.
And this doesn't have anything to do with my life.
Exactly. As opposed to like, no, we're actually providing a real benefit to how this city or wherever we are functions, because we know something about it. And so not being treated as experts, but sort of be treated as sort of like a box to check. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be actually a very particular way of sort of like de-emphasizing their role and their real importance to pushing, you know, a very particular kind of design that ultimately will bring healing, economic, environmental, social, and otherwise, you know, to any particular area.
How does it sound to both of you?
Well, for me, I will say this actually is representation of a larger issue, and I'm happy that this segued into my perfect soapbox. But for me, you know, when you hear about activism, you hear about government officials, you hear about nonprofit executives, how dare they make as much as, you know, $100,000 a year or $500,000. That is just, we're giving you money. You should not be paid as much, because apparently you should only do good things out of the kindness of your
heart.
There
should always be altruism.
Yeah, you don't have a mortgage. But, you know, and which is, it is so interesting to me because, you know, we say, oh, we pay tax dollars to the government agencies. We're donating to these nonprofits. Why are they spending our money on overhead, on people that are working within the space, which truly these are the entities and organizations that are actually developing better solutions that are impacting our daily lives. Mm-hmm. Yet we're okay with spending money on Coca-Cola. I feel like I've called them out a lot today, but, you know, spending money on soda, spending money on brand name clothes, which, you know, it's like we don't take into account that money that you spent is paying for that multi-million dollar salary to that CEO. So why are we okay with spending money and giving all this money to these corporations, but yet with these organizations that are actually bringing value to human life and the sustainability of our world, we just can't do it. It's like, no, how dare us?
I think it's the design of our community, the design of our perceptions of who contributes in a community, right? See, you've got me talking the design language here.
We were going to bring you over sooner or later.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable here about design. Wow, this conversation going in a lot of really interesting directions here. Antoinette Carroll with us. She's a social impact design activist. Uh-oh, Antoinette. And the founder of Creative Reaction Lab. Jesse Kawada with us, a visual strategist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And Majora Carter, CEO of Majora Carter Group. Okay, so if there's something wrong with that design, what we just talked about here, Antoinette, how do we change that? How do we use design to change that?
You know, and for me, it's I look at it, how do we change perceptions? You know, how do we change the makeup of our cities? How do we change, you know, the macro issues that we're addressing that are institutionalized? And for me, it goes back to, you know, individual impact. Many times people think that they can't change the world, but, you know, you change the world every day by impacting one individual or a small group of individuals. And we are so focused on trying to fix this big pie that we just say that it's too complex. I'm not going to do it anyway. So for me to change the perception, you know, we actually have to consciously make an effort to do that, which I can't say that we naturally are. You have many people within the nonprofit space that are writing about it, but they're writing to the people that already know this, the people that are working within the space. And they're like, amen to that. You are speaking the truth. But we're not talking to the general public. We're not talking to the philanthropists. We're not talking to the business leaders and saying, you know, we need to change the way that we're perceiving these organizations that are changing our lives. Like, even the nature of calling nonprofits, you know, it's flawed within itself, because I've had people say to me, well, you're a nonprofit, you're not supposed to make money. And it's like, well, how do we sustain the work that we're doing? How do we extend our reach with limited resources and essentially overworked, you know, staff members to really try to address these larger issues? And I do believe everything is a drop in the bucket. You know, you have some that are activists, you have some that are, you know, are making impact in different ways, and we need allies in all these different areas to really start to fill up the bucket more and more.
Jesse, you look like you're contemplating something here.
I think it, when it comes down to it, it's all about perceptions. I think that people have different definitions of design. And you were talking about the idea of elitism, you know, people with design capabilities are elitist, but I think it's because people think design is just making something look pretty, to be honest. And they're like, okay, well, if it looks good, you know, they have extra money, or they have, you know, they're spending fluffy money. And I think that, you know, this whole, it sounds like this whole journey is about empowering people to understand or empathizing with design, that it's not just making something look pretty. It's it's actually helping the functionality of an idea, of a concept. And I sort of went through that too, of trying to rethink about what design is, because at JPL, you know, the designers are the engineers, and they're, you know, the engineers, the designers, they're the ones creating things, and they're the ones designing. And so their definition of design was completely different.
But
than
do
my
they
definition.
But do they see themselves as designers?
They do, because they do. Their products that they design are these spacefts,
right,
these missions.
But
and
when
so
you
cool.
say you are a rocket scientist or a rocket engineer, design is not the thing that comes into my head. Hardcore math and engineering comes into my head, which is the wrong perception.
Yeah, which is design to them. That's what
that's
it
right.
is. And so it's how do you even call design something else? You know, how it's creative strategy. It's visual strategy. It's, you know,
there's something big
problem
business
solving.
You can get behind.
Yeah. You know, it really, it's creative problem solving. I haven't found a solution, but I would love to see the creative community just think about, how do you change perception? How do you change that culture so that people really empathize with the way that we think and the way that we solve problems?
Yeah, Majora?
I mean, I think especially scientists, because, I mean, look, I'm totally geeking out on everything you're saying completely, because I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you guys design like jet propulsion. So I'm like, are you kidding? That's so cool. But here's what the thing is, I mean, there is, I think, a huge space and that needs to be filled, because the fact that the general public, you know, doesn't necessarily see this, you know, as design is just, that's so sad to me. And because I think we see that just in terms of the sciences in general, that we're not, that, I mean, it's one of the reasons why climate change, for example, is not something that is at the top of most Americans' lists when they think about problems of the world. And it should be. But I think, frankly, many in the science community have not gone out of their way to figure out, how do we share this with regular people so that they feel as though, like, this is meaningful to them. And this is, so, like, this is, our world is changing by the second. Like, why, how can we ensure that people understand that? And that, I think, is a design challenge, because we haven't, like, brought those things together. So, and that's one of the reasons why I love even thinking and contemplating, like, on the work that we do, which is, how do you work to design and create physical changes in communities, mostly through economic developments that meet the needs of people as they're in a low status community, to really see themselves as part of their own future, economically, socially, and environmentally. And whether it's like developing a coffee shop, you know, that gives people probably one of the first places that's not a community center to go hang out and feel like, you know, remind them that they're not like these like poor strapped people all the time. But someplace that's beautiful and that speaks to their aspirations versus, you know, the fact that they are living in a really poor community right now, or that they're seeing their young brothers and sisters actually work in things like tech companies that are located within their own community. Those kind of things, that locating it directly on a main avenue that is more known for, you know, smoke shops and nasty corner stores than it is for tech companies. You know, those type of things. I mean, it provokes, I think, a certain sense of design and creativity in people's heads, where it's just sort of like, oh, like, that was by design, you know, to put it, put something nice here, even though no one would expect to see it here. And so that, you know, building those little models are essentially bridges for people to cross in their own heads about what the future can be for them. It's just, I think it's as we think about science in particular, how we're going to get to that point.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. We're talking about design. Majora Carter with us, Antoinette Carroll and Jesse Kawada. A look at the latest news. We'll be right back to continue the roundtable conversation.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm John Wanamaker. All eyes on Florida, where hundreds of thousands are without power as Hurricane Matthew skims along the state's Atlantic coast. The strongest winds of 120 miles an hour have stayed just offshore. However, a wind gust of 107 miles an hour was recorded in Cape Canaveral. 2 million people had been told to move inland to escape the storm, which left more than 280 dead in the Caribbean. A lot of people, though, decided to stay put and ride out the storm, and authorities say some of them are now stranded and have called for help, but they have been told to wait until conditions improve and emergency crews can reach them. Rains from the outer bands of Matthew are already spinning onto the South Carolina coast. The forecast calls for between 8 and 14 inches of rain in places along the coast, with as much as 4 inches in locations farther inland. Forecasters are warning of a storm surge of 4 to 8 feet. The Russian parliament is debating a treaty with Syria that allows Russian troops to stay indefinitely in the Mideast country. Lawmakers spoke in favor of the agreement, a sign of support for embattled Syrian President Bashar Assad. He has had Moscow's support throughout the devastating civil war. The vote is to be held later today. The treaty allows Russia to keep its forces at an air base in a coastal Syrian province for as long as it wants. Russia launched an air campaign in Syria a year ago, reversing the tide of war and helping Assad's force win some key ground. Stocks down slightly in early trading, about a quarter of 1% after a solid but uninspiring September jobs report. The government reported today that employers added 156,000 jobs last month. That growth has now averaged 178,000 a month this year. That's down from last year's pace of 229,000. The unemployment rate stands at 5%, up a notch after more people started looking for work last month. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Support comes from the attorneys at Sieben Edmonds. If you or a loved one have been charged with a crime, Sieben Edmonds can help. When facing criminal charges, ensure that you have a strong defense. Learn more at siebenedmonds.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about design, and I'm learning the design that you're aware of and the design that you're not aware of. Antoinette Carroll with us. She's a social impact design activist and the founder of Creative Reaction Lab. Jesse Kawada, visual strategist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Majora Carter, CEO of Majora Carter, Inc., which works on urban revitalization projects. And she is not an activist anymore. You live the life of an activist. You just don't call yourself the activist anymore.
But I believe in the self-determination of all people to do as they please. So
okay.
Just didn't work
for
me.
Got it. So Jesse, you brought up an interesting question about usability and design. So what intrigues you about that question?
Yeah, I think design has the power to connect people to an object or connect people to a system or a service. Thinking about, you know, empathizing is a big word in design. How, you know, I'm looking at this pen, I'm looking at this, these headphones, this phone. I know how to use it because it's intuitive.
Right.
You know, you don't have to go and cut through like a million slices to get from point A to point B. It's just like I pick it up and I know how to use it. Push this button. Why do I know that I need to push this button? I don't know. It's was designed for a user, for a person. And I think that's where design, I think, brings that special sauce into a collaboration, is really taking a step back and then doing a little bit of research and investigation and interviews and spending time with an audience to understand the ins and outs of their life, to identify what their needs are, what is their real needs, because design should not be about assumption. It should really be about figuring out the core of a need, you know. And a lot of times these needs from people, from users, no matter who the users are not apparent, you know, until you really dive deep into some core.
As you're saying this, I had this experience recently where I was visiting my dad and we went out to buy his very first iPad. And I use Apple stuff because I find them to be intuitive. This is the first time I've watched somebody who had no experience with a product like this to use it. And what I thought was really intuitive was not as intuitive as I thought, because how do you turn it on? You know, that it was really a lesson in design. Now that I'm hearing you guys talk about this, I realize that's what I was watching. Him just start to try to understand the utility of this. And in the end, it didn't take that long. So I guess it's designed pretty well. But it was interesting to watch him access the design and figure it out.
That's why I've always been intrigued how a 3-year-old, 2-year-old can pick up an iPad
just
start using it.
I know.
There's got to be something about design there.
Well, yeah. I think as adults, we're afraid of looking like we don't know what to do, right? There's no fear in a kid that age. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you hit it on the head when you said access, because, you know, you have some design that is very intuitive, but it's also based on your life experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen people open water bottles and, you know, but kids, they can't open prescription bottles because they haven't had access to doing that yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've worked with many people, and because I'm a Mac and a PC user, it's kind of something you need to know when you work in a nonprofit space, because most of them will not have a Mac. But, you know, I've trained people on moving over to the Mac platform, and it's a completely different world. You know, you use command for one platform, you use control key for another platform, and, you know, the internet doesn't look the same. You know, I had a mentor of mine look at the screen, and he says, "The internet is not popping up. What is happening?" But it was sitting right there, and I was like, "No, it's the screen right in front of you." And he's like, I'm not used to this, because it does come to accessibility. So it is a component of usability, but then also having access to the design itself and making it part of your normalcy. And I love when Jesse talked about, you know, not leading by assumptions, because, you know, many times that is lost upon us. And, you know, we have these stereotypes, we have these perceptions, and, you know, it comes back to, you know, I do diversity and inclusion a lot, or trainees a lot as well. And we talk about cultural competency and how important that is. And, you know, I take it a step further and say, you know, we need to have cultural humility, because, you know, cultural competency in itself could also lead to assumptions, because, you know, we're defining a specific group by X, Y, Z, but that in itself is based on limited research and the access that we have to a specific population. So, you know, for me, usability always comes back to the community that you're working with and serving, and seeing if they even see the benefit and the intuitiveness of the product or the service that was developed in the first place.
What does usability say to you, Majora?
Yeah, it's interesting, because one of the social enterprises that we developed called Startup Box, and it's a software testing services company. And so an engineer will design a piece of software, and then most of that work was usually offshore, the testing of it. But we've actually done some urban onshoring, and so opened up companies within low status communities, and local people are doing that kind of testing. Mm. And the interesting thing that is cracking me up about listening to you guys talk is that, so a developer is like, they're in love with the piece of software that they develop, but because they're so into it, they don't necessarily think about the end user and how they use it. So it takes like a person who's not making that much money, you know, actually looking at their piece of work and saying, like, is the user going to really feel the same way that you do about your software? And if they don't, you know, that's a problem, because it means if you're producing a game, you know, people won't spend that much time on it.
Absolutely.
And they'll get zero ratings or a bad review, which means that all the work they put in, it just goes into the toilet. So it's so fascinating that, and it's called quality assurance, that kind of testing that allows, like, are you paying attention to the end user? That's really all it is. Like, are you willing to take that extra step and go, you know what, I built this beautiful piece, whatever it is, whether it's software, whether it's a park, whether it's a building, who cares what it is, but have you tested it to make sure that your intended audience feels as strongly about it as you do? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in life, and even in the design world, we don't do that.
Doesn't that happen
it
at JPL, where the engineers are designing for the astronauts that are going to be using this beautiful design, and when, I don't know, they're under stress, does that design make sense for them to make these quick decisions?
Right. Well, you know, in terms of our human exploration program, there's not a lot of designers that work with those programs that come up with these solutions, and which is ironic,
which is so crazy.
You know, they're human. The users are the human. But
who works with them if it's not?
You know, it's a scientist. It's a lot of psychologists. A lot of, you know, you have a PhD. You work with them. They haven't really discovered design as we know it to integrate with those processes. But
wow.
I think they better put in a call to
Antoinette.
Yeah, we're about to for you.
But I think it's, you know, going back to the micro to the macro, you know, there's some people that just look at the micro, you know, and there's some people that just look at the macro.
Yeah,
and
right.
I think design has the power to look at both ends of the spectrum. And I think that's really important, kind of good design. You know, if somebody's really into their one, their software, their coding, or their like engineering tool, or this, you know, even if they can't connect to the user, like bring in a designer to like connect those dots.
Help you.
And, you know, I really see how design thinking can play a role within that space, because when we think about design thinking, it really depends on the organization you talk to. They have a 5-step program, a 9-step program, but it really could be distilled down to, you know, research, making, and testing. And, you know, it's in those moments we are missing that key piece. Like, you know, when you were talking about, you know, will they actually use this piece and having the end users engage with it? Well, if someone would have prototyped that before actually spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on it, you know, they would have saw, you know, mistakes here and there. You know, a great example of this is Google Glass, where the creator of the product, like he went through, he built the first prototype, if I remember correctly, in like 45 minutes. And, you know, people were like, oh, I love it. It's great. But then as he noticed people continue to use the Google Glass, you know, we have this image of the Minority Report and how we swipe left, we swipe right, and it worked. It will be amazing. We want that to happen. But he noticed that, you know, people's arms got tired after a while. And you know, people were like, I'm tired. And he was like, you know, well, that's not going to work.
Right.
And then, and he literally were building these prototypes out of plexiglass and straws and string. You know, he wasn't buying, you know, this electric, you know, this expensive metal and actually building it and having people test in that moment. But it was all about, you know, usability within that time frame. And I think we can apply that to products, we can apply it to services. And that's really where design thinking can come play a role, because I think Jesse's right. We do see the spectrum of, you know, the micro versus the macro. And, you know, design thinking have elements of anthropology and sociology and psychology in it, but then also, you know, the making and the sciences. Like we're a perfect merging.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what hurts us, is because we can't truly be defined to one specific area. We are literally a hodgepodge of greatness.
Nicely said. Nicely done. I keep thinking, Majora, when you were going down the list of where design is, that you said one of your examples was a park. And when I think of usability, I think you can have the best intentions in the world of, you know, bringing this verdant green space into a community. But if it doesn't make sense for the people that live there and they won't go there, boy, and that happens.
Right.
I mean, you live in New York City. I walk around New York City and see beautiful green spaces empty. All the time. What happened?
They weren't designed well.
Right.
It was my favorite. When I learned this phrase, I was like, oh my gosh, it's brilliant. Crime prevention through environmental design. I was like, oh, okay. No, you don't want like big bushy areas, you know, where things could go on that you can't see. You want to be able to have like the kind of open spaces, you know, where people can feel like it's private, but you know what, bottom line is they're in view.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. And it's not that hard to do, but again, someone's got to take the time to know that this is an issue and it needs to be addressed. And then along the way, make sure that you're, you know, doing the self-correct by asking, you know, input along the way. Otherwise, you'll get something that will just never be used.
And for me, it's like, it's also intention versus impact, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we have these great intentions. And I love that you brought up social enterprise, because it's like all these different organizations came in my mind of, you know, we have these programs overseas that, hey, why don't we create a playground where kids are pushing the Ferris wheel and that will pump water. And what they found is that over time, kids weren't even using the playground. And there we have another failed experiment in a community that we don't understand, and that we just wanted to come in with this kind of savior type of complex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it also made me think of a story of a friend of mine. Her name is DeAndra Nichols, and she's also in St. Louis, and she's a social design activist as well. It's like, we're all activists over here. but, you know, she was in a community that she didn't live. She was there through a design program in down south, and they wanted to create these basketball hoops out of recycled materials that were, you know, due to tsunamis and hurricanes, and actually teach children how to recreate while also having them something to engage with, you know, within their neighborhoods. And when they went in to put up these basketball hoops, they, you know, community members actually came and were yelling at them and was like, why are you doing this? You don't understand our community. We actually intentionally took mm-hmm. down the basketball hoops because we noticed that basketball brought crime to our community. So it actually made it safer for our younger toddlers to not have basketball hoops. Mm-hmm. And that is a great example of how we come in with these great intentions and we have this assumption that, you know, I need to fix this problem. Apparently you can't fix it yourself. And then the impact, it's complete opposite of what we need. And so design thinking and design kind of helps mitigate that. But designers ourselves, sometimes we're not perfect. We make mistakes as well. But it's just really being intentional in the work and make sure that we're conscious of, you know, these issues as well.
So was there, so I'm just curious about, you know, so once they heard that, okay, these young men are coming in, you know, crime happens in these places, but was there also a connection to, you know, the fact that these young men were not working? And maybe there mm-hmm. needed to be more opportunities for economic development. So because that, because as far
I
as
agree
I'm concerned,
with that. Yeah.
the best form of social service is a job.
Amen.
And how we create those opportunities so that they're safe places for the kids to play, and that you know our young men and women, you know, actually are gainfully employed and therefore constructive, mm-hmm. productive parts of our society.
One of the projects that just recently came from one of our labs, because we host these 24-hour or weekend model labs
this
using design thinking.
This sounds like a great
thinking idea,
by the way. It's just this 24-hour all-in.
It's like we force you just to get it done because, you know, life gets in the way. But, you know, we recently did a lab looking at gun violence, which mm-hmm. obviously has a lot of different elements that play a role within that space. But one of the ideas that came out was called Body Count, one of them was Body Count, but the one I want to talk about is the Storytelling House, where their mm-hmm. idea was to rebuild a life by rebuilding a house and working with people that youth that have been incarcerated, bringing them back to their community, having them build up the house, actually have jobs that will, you know, impact their daily, you know, their day-to-day interactions. But then from there, once the house is built, they turn into mentors for other mm-hmm. youth within the community. So, you know, it's, you know, we have all these different elements that play a role with these systemic issues, such as poverty. But with that project itself, which was the Hoops Project, I'm going to be honest. No, they did not consider that. And actually, my friend, she actually was very upset about how it ended.
Mm.
There were parameters of the program that they were required to finish the product mm-hmm. anyway, but they didn't do it in that community. They went to another community to put them up.
Can I close what has been a superb roundtable here? A lot of great sparking of ideas. With a question about the places you all go to for inspiration when it comes to design.
I'm a bit of a nerd, and mm-hmm. I like to be inspired by science. So I go to NOAA website. I go to our own NASA website. I read, you know, national climate assessments. I watch National Geographic.
Antoinette, how about you?
The main design website I go to is actually called Impact Design Hub, and it's literally about all these different social solutions to design problems throughout the world, and, you know, opportunities to get involved as well as to help you kind of build your own craft.
Okay. And how about you, Majora?
I have to say I don't follow any major or minor design website, but just because of the nature of my work, I am actually in front of many people all over the country. So I actually get to go visit places mm-hmm. where these amazing design activations are happening.
Thank you all for an enlightening and a fun roundtable.